Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss Pulsifer versus United States, in which the Supreme Court issued a 6-3 decision on March 15, 2024. We are joined today by Vikrant Reddy. Vikrant is a senior fellow at Stand Together Trust, specializing in the area of criminal justice reform. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to our guest to discuss the overview of the case and the court's decision.
Well, thanks so much, Kyle. This is a really fun case to talk about. It's the kind of case that lawyers just love, and it's the kind of case that maybe explains why non-lawyers hate lawyers so much. The entire case is about determining whether or not the word and means and, or whether or not the word and means or. You might think that sounds completely insane. When would and ever mean or? But there's a plausible argument, and I'll give it. But first, let's start with a little bit of the backstory here. The case concerns a man named Mark Pulsifer, who was busted and convicted for drug crimes in Iowa, methamphetamine, if I remember correctly. And he had a bit of a record, and he was subject to a federal mandatory minimum sentence. And that sentence would have been up to 15 years behind bars. Now, there were some extenuating circumstances with him, and there is a safety valve provision that allows judges to depart from that mandatory minimum if they think that, well, this is a unique case, and Mr. Pulsifer is not necessarily the kind of guy that you'd want to put away for 15 years. That's not penologically necessary. But some people are not eligible for the safety valve. You're not eligible for the safety valve if you have a particular kind of criminal history. We don't need to go into the details of what the criminal history provisions are. For the sake of this case, even Justice Kagan in her majority opinion said, just to make things simple, let's just say that if you have A, B, and C, you are exempt from the safety valve protection. Now, the question is not what A means, what B means, or what C means. It's what and means when you say A, B, and C. And this matters. It matters big time because what Mr. Pulsifer was saying was that we all agree that I did A, and we all agree that I did B, but I didn't do C. We all agree on that also. And because I didn't do C, this doesn't apply to me. I'm exempt. But the other side is saying, no, you did A and you did B, and that's adequate, and we don't even have to get into the C portion of it. And this matters big time because, again, he's subject to a 15-year mandatory minimum sentence. It also matters for people beyond him because this entire provision comes out of the 2018 federal criminal justice reform called the First Step Act. And there are 10,000 federal defendants who are in a similar position to Mr. Pulsifer. And they were obviously watching this case very closely to figure out, okay, what's the court going to say? Does and mean and, or does and mean or? Let's dig into that a little bit because I think listeners are probably already going, how is this even possible? What have we been talking about for the last 5 minutes without getting into this completely bizarre question? You probably think that if I were to say, Kyle, I'm making a salad, can you run to the store and pick up spinach, tomatoes, and carrots? That means pick up all three things, spinach, tomatoes, and carrots. If you come home with just one item or two items, you didn't get the order correct, right? That seems very obvious to everybody. And this is more or less the case that that Mr. Pulsifer and the dissenters, actually, in this opinion, are making. Justice Kagan and the majority said, well, it's not really that simple. And we can all come up with examples where and actually means or. In fact, she says, I'll pull one right out of the Constitution. There's a provision of the Constitution, which probably everybody on this call is familiar with, that says that the judicial power, power in Article 3, shall extend to all cases arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties. Everybody understands that what that means is that a case has got to come out of the Constitution, out of the various laws of the United States, or out of treaties. It doesn't mean that a case has to be under all three things simultaneously. That'd be completely absurd. There are very few things like that in the first place. Everybody gets that, and that's really not even any kind of a point of debate. So there are cases, she and the majority argue, in which and can mean or. And in this particular case, she thinks it's plausible that and means or, which is what the government was arguing. So Mr. Pulsifer comes back and argues, no, there are instances where you have a negation, where you're speaking in the negative, where it's clear that and means and the example provided here is suppose you say don't drink and drive. Everybody understands that don't drink and drive does not mean don't ever drink and don't ever drive. It means don't drink and drive simultaneously. Don't do those two things together. We're in a podcast, so it doesn't make sense that I'm gesturing with my hands, but I am to say these are two things that happen simultaneously. That's what don't drink and drive means. But you know, this entire opinion is almost like a prize fight, and two heavyweights are just going back and forth against each other, coming up with hypothetical after hypothetical to counter the other one's hypothetical. And here, Justice Kagan comes right back against the dissent, which was written by Justice Gorsuch, and says, no, you can think of negations that work in the way that I'm talking about. So for example, suppose I met someone's parents and I said, I didn't like his mother and father. That doesn't mean I didn't like his mother separately and I didn't like his father separately, but as long as the two of them were together, just fine. No, when I say I didn't like his mother and father, that means I didn't like his parents, period, whether they were separate or whether they were together. They go back and forth like this, hypothetical after hypothetical after hypothetical. It's actually just fascinating to read. And it's really, if you're interested in linguistics, a number of linguists actually submitted an amicus brief in this case. It's just so interesting to think through the hypotheticals. And there are perfectly plausible cases on both sides of this. The and means and position, which the government argued and which Justice Kagan and the majority agreed with, was also a position that the Eighth Circuit agreed with, that the 11th Circuit agreed with, and that the Fourth Circuit agreed with. On the other hand, the and means or provision, excuse me, and means and is Gorsuch's and the dissent's position. But the and means or position was a position that was agreed with by the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit. I mean, it's really very closely divided, and you've got very prominent federal judges on both sides of this thing who can easily see it both ways. But ultimately, you know, somebody's got to win. What's the famous line from Justice Robert Jackson many years ago? He said that the Supreme Court was not final because it's infallible. It's infallible because it's final. So someone's got to make a final call here. And the final call was in favor of viewing and as or. And it did mean that Mr. Pulsifer was not eligible for safety valve relief. And I'm sorry to say for the 10,000 similarly situated federal defendants, they too were not eligible for safety valve relief. I keep saying Kagan, but I should mention that the Kagan majority was an interesting majority because in addition to Justice Kagan, it was the Chief Justice, it was Justice Barrett, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Alito, Justice Thomas. Ordinarily, that's a group of conservatives, but they were joined by Justice Kagan, who's viewed as a progressive on the court. The dissent, similarly, it's kind of an unusual dissent. It was Justice Gorsuch, generally viewed as a conservative, but joined by Justice Jackson and Justice Sotomayor, ordinarily viewed as progressives. I think it's really important to point this out because a lot of people who are not lawyers or who don't follow the Supreme Court very closely assume that everything that comes out of the court goes 6-3, and it's just a very traditional conservative progressive split. That is a lot of the very hot button culture war-y type cases that you read about in the front page of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. But you and I know, Kyle, that the court's work consists of lots of interesting intellectual property and bankruptcy, and in this case, criminal justice issues that don't cut cleanly down these kinds of partisan lines. They're just actually really interesting and sophisticated legal arguments on both sides. And that stuff doesn't always depend on what your politics are or what your, maybe to be more generous, what your ideological priors about law are necessarily.
Well, thank you so much for covering this for us. I think this is a really, you know, fascinating topic because people don't think of it in this sense all the time. Right. You said that there were obviously implications for these 10,000 other defendants who are now no longer eligible for the safety valve. Do you see that there being any other ramifications because of this decision regarding other types of nebulous or vague laws that kind of use the same distinction?
So I was asked this question by someone recently, and I said there are two ways to think about it. The first is that it's not going to have a lot of clear precedential value because the winning argument, if it had been "and means and," let's just read the words, you know, on their face, that would have a lot of precedential value. But the winning argument actually was sometimes "and" means "or," it depends on context. And that argument that, well, sometimes it depends on context is not something that has clear precedential value. There's always going to be different kinds of context. But I think one thing that could possibly, it's a remote possibility, but a real possibility, have some significant value down the line and significant implications, is Justice Gorsuch's long discussion about something called the rule of lenity. The rule of lenity is this very old principle in law. It's an old principle that goes back to British common law and is older than America itself. It is the idea that when you are interpreting a criminal statute, and you're not really sure how to interpret it, it could go this way or that way, you should ultimately interpret it in favor of the individual and against the government. And you do that because you live in a society that deeply values individual liberty, that is skeptical of government power, that wants to encourage precision in government drafting of laws and statutes. And so whenever it's a close call, whenever it seems like it's very nearly a tie, the tie goes to the individual, not the government. So this is a very old principle. It's called the rule of lenity. It's something that increasingly, I think, has been disregarded in modern interpretation. But it's a very important canon of construction. It's actually written about in a very important book called Reading Law by Justice Scalia and Brian Garner. Just about every lawyer I know has got Reading Law on their bookshelf. Mine is back there somewhere. And it is a principle that Justice Gorsuch is trying very hard to revive. He doesn't have a lot of support right now. He's written about this in previous opinions. There was a case called Wooten. I can't remember if it was a D or a T in that case, but versus the United States out of last term, where once again, he wrote about the rule of lenity, wrote about reviving it, wrote about how the court needs to take it more seriously. But he encountered some resistance. I think Justice Kavanaugh, for reasons I don't particularly recall at the moment, in that case, was skeptical of its application. I know that in this case, the justices in the majority were skeptical because they said the rule of lenity is something you get to if the original meaning is unclear. And they really felt like it was pretty clear that in context here, "and" meant "or." So they didn't feel they had to get to that. But obviously, Justice Gorsuch and Jackson and Sotomayor saw it differently. In fact, Gorsuch is, I should say, is pretty annoyed in his dissent. He says, look, there are three ways to address this case, and we're just disregarding all of them. The first is just look at the words on the page, "and" means "and." The second, which we should talk about for a second, is look at the context. This came out of the First Step Act. This was legislation that was designed to alleviate the very harsh sentences that federal law places on nonviolent drug offenders. That's what Congress was trying to do. And that's what President Trump was trying to do when he signed the bill into law. I mean, when you have a case involving a nonviolent drug offender like Mr. Pulsifer, you really need to interpret it in the way that you could interpret it in the way that accords with legislative intent. I should say could, because I think the people on this call, Federal Society members, have a good understanding of why legislative intent and legislative history are limited. Justice Scalia wrote a lot about that during his life. And in fact, I don't really think that's the best way to decide the case. I think probably the plain text, and if that doesn't work for you, relying on the rule of lenity make a lot of sense. But what Gorsuch was saying was, if you want to do plain text, if you want to do relying on legislative history, or if you want to do just go with the rule of lenity, any one of those would get you to the same result, and the majority is disregarding all three. So he was clearly irritated by it. I do wonder whether or not his cry into the wilderness in favor of the rule of lenity is the kind of thing that eventually could be taken more seriously by the entire court. You know, Justice Scalia wrote dissent after dissent after dissent for decades before he really started changing minds, because he changed the minds of law students and changed the minds of new judges in the on the federal bench and ultimately on the Supreme Court, even changed the minds of some colleagues who are with him for a while there. That's the kind of thing you're looking for in dissents, is this person making an argument that could change our law in the future, even if it didn't win out in this case. There's a possibility of it here.
Well, thank you so much for doing this with us. I think that was, you really took this case that for a lot of people is a bit confusing, and I think you really brought some light to it. And I wanted to thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for hosting me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers. Founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.